We're doing some reading today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We'll ask reader Cherry McIlvaine what books interest her. Then we'll ask Garrison Keillor for the Writer's Almanac on Scribble.
Well, Cherry, you are here today because a few weeks ago I heard you say, how many years have you retired from teaching?
30 years.
And you said the other day, every day I wake up in the morning, I miss the classroom. And that's astounding. Given the teachers I know, most of whom are worn out and would just as soon forget about it. Let's start at the beginning. How did you even get into English teaching?
Well, I, of course, was married at the time. I had graduated from Monmouth College and had a year and a half of law school at the University of Michigan. And then I eloped with Paul McIlvaine, and we started in raising children. And when Scott got into junior high, it was clear that somebody was going to have to go out and do a little extra earning of money. So I went to Augustana to get teacher credits from Don Peterson, and I really enjoyed that. Had Henrietta Nathan in class and a number of the other teachers, and so then I went out to apply for a job.
Why English?
English I always loved, and I was a debater in high school and college, and I loved English literature. And so it was going to be English.
Well, why teaching? Because there were many more jobs that paid better in those days.
Well, like what?
Well, certainly not being in television. We used to envy teachers and reporters' salaries.
I really enjoyed teaching from the get-go. And I was offered jobs in United Township, but that was going to be 2 hours east and west.
Oh, yeah.
And I was offered a job at J.B. Young Junior High School in Davenport. So that was just going to be across the river. And so I took that job. Daryl Spons hired me, and it was a wonderful opportunity for me.
But teaching is the hardest job I've ever had. I mean, and I've worked at a lot of different things, but trying to keep students, 20 to 30 I had in class, involved and committed, and you know that is hard because they're all so different.
Well, I totally agree, Don, and I'm not going to say that I was the best teacher they ever had either. But as far as I'm concerned, from my perspective, I loved it enough to say to the family from time to time that I would have taught without a salary.
Well, that's the secret. I would have done everything I've done in my life for free.
Yes.
Because it was so much fun.
So much
fun. So what is there about teaching that's so rewarding?
It's the conversations and the interplay with the kids. I feel right now that if I had the strength and energy, I would be glad to go back to the classroom.
You were able to get kids to talk in class.
Sure. Get kids
in. How did you do that?
Well, you don't talk down to them. That's number one. Never talk down to the kids. Don't if they are interested in how things were when you were growing up, they'll ask you. But don't talk down to them and say, well, you know, and preach. You don't do that. You just involve them in conversation, and if you just talk to them as another human being, they're fine. I still say when I hear about how terrible things are today in school, I think, well, I wonder.
Well, Roald and I were on the faculty of a little, we were teaching a session on teaching classics in schools, and we had teachers there from GED classes all the way through high school. Mm-hmm. And the last day I asked them, well, you've listened to us, now we want to hear from you. And they talked to us about teaching. And I remember Roald and I looked at each other and thought, we could never do this.
Oh, really? Yeah. What did they say?
It was just very tough. Situations in classrooms were tough.
Mm-hmm. Nowadays.
Nowadays. Mm-hmm. People, kids with so many different languages. Back in the day, most of kids came from two-parent homes. The pressures on kids through social media and television and so on are multiplied way beyond what they were years ago. And all those are way on kids. And keeping them in range is sometimes very difficult. It takes great skill, great patience.
Let me go back and ask the sort of basic nasty question. Why should kids be required to take literature? I obviously you need to know how to read and you need to know a little math, although less and less today than you did. But why should people read Jane Austen or Shakespeare or any of those? If they want to, that's fine, but why require it?
Because these people are well-known and famous writers who tell stories that all of us can relate to. Everyone can relate to the things you hear in a story by William Shakespeare. And so you take Henry V over there at the Genesius Guild. Tell me the student that can't relate to looking at our political situation, can't look to Henry V and see parallels. Jane Austen has a wonderful way of putting things in Pride and Prejudice. The girls nowadays can wish that was like that. It really is just wonderful. Literature has so much to offer, and so all you have to do is involve the kids in. And really, there you can't justify everything that you teach. I remember trying to do poetry and having a young man, Scotty Maynard, in my class that said, "Well, Mrs. McElveen, how come I've got to know onomatopoeia to run a pool hall?"
That's a good question. And would that help him?
It's going to enrich his life.
Well,
you just can't tell when you might be able to use something related to poetry.
Well, the difference is that education, you go to school to learn to think.
Yes.
And you can always use thinking all your life if you're interested in it.
Yeah. A critical thinker.
Yeah, critical thinking. Yeah, there's a great book on that, too, that we'll be talking about one of these days. But the whole business of education is to get kids to think.
Right.
Not just to go through rote stuff, learn this, memorize this, read that, take this test, and that's it.
And I remember that it was Don Wooten who said that if you look at the Greek plays, you can see all kinds of parallels between what happened in the Greek plays and what's happening now. And it's a wise young person who looks at those models and does his careful analysis of what's happening now. And I think there's too many devices and distractions for these young people so that they can't really get a grip on the real values.
Why do you think kids are, by the time they get to you in junior high and high school, they tend to be turned off by poetry or afraid of it? I never could get it. I just never got the hang of poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see where I'd say, let's give it a try. We'll do a unit on poetry, and we'll try a lot of variety, and maybe have them bring a poem that they can, that they do relate to, or write. Give them some parameters and let them write some poetry and then analyze it in class. There, a lot of young people really can relate to poetry. I think we could handle that, unit.
The key is don't go Keats and Shelley. Get Phyllis McGinley, somebody like that, or Ogden Nash.
Yes.
I mean, get somebody that opens the door easily and wide.
Right.
And then move on
yes.
to the heavyweights. Don't start with the big ones.
Right.
Start with where they are. And if you show me a kid that would not relate to Phyllis McGinley, and I'll show you a kid who is not alive.
Right.
I mean, it's just that.
What poets did you have most success with?
Poets?
Yeah. Teaching.
Oh, gee. That now you're putting me on the spot, Roy.
Well, I hope to.
That's his job. He's obnoxious that way.
Of course, all of the Shakespeare I consider poetry, you know, I really do. But I would say Keats and Shelley and Lord Byron and
Wordsworth.
I've got to say the old poets. I don't have do much with the new ones, so but I hear a lot about them, and so I'd be willing to try.
Well, I think the problem is the new ones. More and more, you know, the world is getting divided into compartments, and a lot of poets today, many of the poets that write in Poetry Magazine write for other poets.
Yeah, right.
Right, and are probably further and further removed from the classroom that you or I taught in. Mm-hmm.
I will tell the whole world and every teacher who listens, if you want to get kids into poetry, start with Phyllis McGinley.
You've said
I
that.
I am passionate about that because she is so accessible and yet profound.
Mm-hmm.
She's entertaining, she's funny, but there's stuff in there that really clicks.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't even in your textbook, though,
no.
was she?
No,
she isn't. Wow. As a matter of fact, I think her books might be out of print now, which is just a crime.
And, in fact, another of your favorites, Edna St. Vincent Millay,
has
sort of fallen off the cliff, too.
Yeah, that's true. And Dorothy Parker.
And she was wonderful, Dorothy Parker.
Do you read a lot to this day?
Yes, I do. Reading is my entertainment. Well, of course, I watch TV, of course, I admit that. But I read all the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, all kinds of
what
things.
Kind of stuff do you read?
Well, I belong to two book clubs, and so I'm not, I don't know that I can recommend everything that they pull up.
You're not a free agent completely.
No. I read four newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
And so that really is, you know, so that if anybody comes in and wants to talk about what's happening in the world, I really feel that I have a pretty good grasp on that. And I like to be a critical reader and thinker. So, you know, there's the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And then I found out at Abras that the Quad City Times was not held in as high regard as the Rock Island Argus and Dispatch.
Well,
do you want to get, you know?
Yeah, that you have to talk to the right people.
But I was very disappointed only this week to find that two obituaries that I wanted to, I was very interested in. And I'm into obituaries at my age.
Aren't we all?
Were in the Quad City Times and they didn't make it to the Argus. And so that's
and
very
vice versa sometimes, too.
Yeah.
Partly because now, from word one an obituary, you pay.
I know.
And also, funeral homes are the ones, as we learned, who write the obituaries. And the survivors decide where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that right?
You know, that's why you have that division.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't always occur, but you'll notice in one newspaper is a long obituary.
Yes.
The other one, 2 inches. And that's a choice.
That's because the newspaper did that?
No.
Not the family?
No, the family chooses, because it's a charge. You pay for it.
Yeah. You get 10 inches free, isn't it?
Yeah, that's about it.
Mm-hmm. When you were grading papers, Sherry, did you favor correctness or creativity?
Creativity, I got to say.
And why would that be?
Because I really think that's such a rare commodity, you know. So if you've got a creative student, I figure you can teach him how to say it better if you really work at it and his grammar and what have you. It's that creativity. What difference does it make if you say something positively and well and everything, but it's nothing worth saying?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, quite often, you know, I mean, that's sort of what students learn. You know, you ask a 3-year-old what she thinks of Grandma's hat, and she said, "Stupid." You know, by the time she's seven, she'd say, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And by the time she's a senior in high school, she'd say, well, that's just you, Grandma.
Yes. You know, I mean,
we don't learn to express ourselves. We learn to sort of depress ourselves.
Yeah. Well, to censor ourselves and to be kind. There's nothing wrong with being kind. There's a lot of talk about political correctness. We should be able to call people
right.
what
mm-hmm.
we want. And my response is, didn't your mother teach you any manners at all?
mm-hmm.
There's just such a thing as being nice.
Yes,
and there's
sure
nothing
is.
Wrong with being nice
uh-huh.
in all circumstances.
Nice and kind, like you said.
Yes, that's
and
true.
Kind.
I asked you a week or so ago what your favorite novel was to teach, and you said it was Knowles' A Separate Peace, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
It had so many levels of meaning in there. A Separate Peace, and of course, here was this student there that was in school, and all of the different struggles that he had, the different people that he met. It was a good opportunity to do character study too with students, and they could relate to the mm-hmm. Young people in A Separate Peace, and the anxieties that they had, and the situations they confronted.
And that went over well with students?
Yes, it did. It was a novel that you could teach year after year, and it seemed to be something they could relate to. So,
are you a fiction or nonfiction fan?
Well, I don't know what to say on that, Don. A lot of fiction I like very well, but I read a lot of nonfiction. So in this one book club, they won't accept a nonfiction book, and I really think that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Oh, there's
why?
I don't know. They think that the fiction is so great, and you know, so we've got to try this author, and over and over again. And some of these stories, I'll come out of there and say, the girls in the car, do you really think it was worth reading?
Mm-hmm.
See, so maybe my objection is to some of the choices we make about what we're going to read.
Well, more and more, you know, as the world goes on, news comes out in short segments that are not satisfying on radio and television. In a newspaper, you get a fuller account. Magazines, you really find there's depth to this, but a book will tell you the whole story.
The whole story.
Now, there's some authors who are absolute frauds and propagandists. But those who delve into something deeply, those books must be read.
Yes.
Those
absolutely.
Are really important.
Uh-huh. There are some magazines, like The Economist,
yeah.
that will do a wonderful workmanlike job with their background study, and they'll do all the peripheral issues mm-hmm. connected with the subject. And
I turn to the last page first.
That obituaries.
Their obituaries are so fascinating.
They are.
They will pick somebody who has recently died that uh-huh. you may never have heard of.
Uh-huh.
And you read that and you think, what an interesting life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Cherry, I happen to know that you were one of those teachers, and it certainly doesn't happen to all teachers, upon whom students pulled practical jokes.
Oh. You do.
Why do you think that was?
They thought I could take it, you know. Like
that's a good sign.
Yeah,
I think, right?
They thought it would be fun to see my reaction, and I never really got mad. I was always, you know, okay. If you can pull a practical joke, that's okay. You know, let me pull one on you. Like the kid I used to teach in a trailer. And I advised the yearbook at Central High School, and so I would get a phone call and go in the office to answer the phone, and the kids, one group, advanced the clock. And I fell for it, and they had a wonderful time.
Well, our clock has advanced a little too far now. We're going to have to wind up. But Cherry McElvain, it's been a delight to talk to you. It's been a long time since we've talked. One of the last times you told me about my daughter Cece hiding her books in the back of your yard.
Did you tell Cece about it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, now she reads a lot. Yeah. Yeah, so avoiding it in school, she's come to it in her maturity.
Oh, how great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
A pleasure to be with you, too, as well.
Yeah, well, it's been a long time.
Yeah,
we used to be just a few doors apart.
I know. Yeah. And I remember when you came over to our front door, and you answered the door, and you were Richard III. David was going to buy a car we had, and you, we answered the door, and there you were, Richard III, right there.
Well, even kings must deal in commerce. And right now, we're going to deal with Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Delightful conversation with Sherry.
It's always delightful. She's 90 years old. She still is excited, you know, about ideas and things as she ever was.
Yeah, well, we have just a couple of minutes here. Do you have recommendations?
I have a couple of books that ought to be read back to back. I just did that by accident. The first of these is a book that's made a lot of splash recently, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. It's the book that incoming Augustana students have to read this year. And then just as I was finishing that, Don Erickson gave me a book called Janesville, An American Story by Amy Goldstein, who's a writer for the Washington Post. Both of these books deal with what happens to a community when jobs disappear completely, manufacturing jobs. In the Hillbilly Elegy case, J.D. Vance, who himself is from Hill Country in Kentucky, much of his family and many of the people, his neighbors, moved to a little town in Ohio to take manufacturing jobs, and then one day those jobs disappear. How do they handle it? And then Janesville, 4,500 jobs overnight, the GM plant in Janesville closed. And not only did 4,500 jobs go, but along with it, all the little manufacturing companies that made seats for the cars and other things. So Janesville was in real trouble, too. But what is interesting is how these two cultures handle it. Hillbilly country, you know, is based on family. I didn't realize till I read this book that church attendance is not very high in the Bible Belt in the South, in the hills of Kentucky, because people don't like institutions. They're deeply religious, but it's family.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go in and call a policeman if somebody steals from you. You get the guy back, right?
Yeah.
And here is a group of people in Ohio, formerly hillbillies, who still have relatives back in Kentucky. How do they handle the loss of jobs? Here's Janesville, which has a strong union, which is a community college that can retrain workers. How do they come back? And the difference in the way these communities try to come back is astounding. What is amazing, however, is that none of that works. Community colleges, well, and I think Blackhawk does it, has a lot of programs for retraining. You lost this manufacturing job. We'll retrain you for welding. We'll retrain you for computer repair. We'll train you for this. Statistically, how little of that really works.
Well, you know, it's great to be trained for a job, but what if the job isn't there?
Well,
that's the problem.
There can't be that many computer repairmen, right? I mean,
yeah.
And so neither of these communities, as differently as they try to solve their problems, ever really make it back.
Yeah, well, it's Janesville and Hillbilly Elegy are Roll's recommendations, and we recommend that you join us again next week. We'll be back with another session of Scribble.